Unsolved Mysteries Rewind is a commercial-free podcast that focuses on cases featured on the television show Unsolved Mysteries. Each episode features a single case and, if possible, updates and an expansion on the original story. Listener discretion is advised for listeners who are sensitive to true crime details.
Tonight on Unsolved Mysteries Rewind, two friends get together to discuss episodes of their favorite television show, Unsolved Mysteries. Will they find answers? Will anyone care? You may be able to solve a mystery.
Hello, this is Mark, and you are listening to Unsolved Mysteries Rewind. Today, I have a very special introduction to make. Her name is Catherine. How are you doing, Catherine?
I'm good, Mark. How are you on this fine Thursday?
Is it Thursday? I don't even know. Catherine is stepping into the role of helping bring Unsolved Mysteries Rewind to its new horizon. And I couldn't appreciate it more. Thank you so much for stepping up into that role, Catherine. And I look forward to all the work that we're going to be throwing on the table and getting done.
I could not be more excited.
And today, the episode in on the table.
We are covering
Season 12, Episode 7.
One case originally aired as a special alert on the April 19th, 1996 episode.
What does that mean? I saw that. What does special alert mean?
I think in the original segments, they would have little blurbs at the end of the episode.
Attention, this is a special alert. That type of thing?
Yes. And they wouldn't really elaborate on the case, but they would show the criminal's picture and keep on the alert. Hmm. And then, so that was for Con Artist Cop. And it got its own segment on the July 30th, 2001 episode.
So what we're going to be covering are three pretty great stories, I think. The first one brings us down to Houston, Texas. I believe our first of two Texas stories. This one's entitled Black Hope Curse. This goes back to 1982.
We first meet the Haneys, Sam and Judith, and they are so cute.
They just seem like they get along and play like Marjan on Wednesdays.
Loved their voices. Mm-hmm. I'm a sucker for a good Texas drawl.
Sure.
But they bought a house in Newport, and it was the house that we had always been looking for. So it was the house that we had intended to stay at for a long period of time. But then
this is a brand new development in Texas. These are all brand new houses at the time.
A year after they bought the house, and Sam was having a hole dug in their backyard for a swimming pool.
Fancy, right? I mean, when I hear that people are putting in their own, you know, in-ground pools, I just get so jealous.
I have an above-ground pool. Oh,
it's still sort of fancy. But pools are kind of a pain in the butt. I grew up with an in-ground, and I know that it was always, like, on maintenance. So, yeah, they're going to dig, you know, they're going to even excavate their brand-new property even more by putting an in-ground in.
So, one day, an elderly man showed up at his door to report that he was about to dig up human remains.
This is, like, the shadiest part of the story, in my opinion.
Right. And I tried to find more on this elderly gentleman. I couldn't really find out who he was. They didn't elaborate on who he was in the segment. But they continue digging because they want to find these supposed remains. And they find 25 bone fragments. And some were so brittle that they fell apart when they were touched.
Right.
And two wedding rings were also discovered.
And I think what ended up happening is that they did rebury the remains. And I'm going to assume that these people being, at least from what we can tell, right? You can't just tell everything. But they seem like to be pretty good people. They would put the jewelry back in with the remains. But I wonder, is it technically their property? I wonder. I bet it is. Like a finder's probably. Keeper on my property type of thing. They did the right thing by reburying the remains. I think it was a really nice gesture, very respectful. But also the entire idea of all of this is kind of creepy.
And they were able to find a longtime resident named Jasper Norton, who had dug several graves in the area when he was a teenager. And so he was able to
100 or something. I mean, if he was
in the 1980s, they said the couple died in the 1930s.
You know, so what,
if
you're
he
right.
was a teenager yeah. in the 1930s, he was probably maybe 60.
Yeah, if he was in his 60s or even his 70s, he would have been fine. You're right. Fine. Oh. I'm just kidding. But yeah, they found Jasper Norton because he had worked there, I guess, digging the graves. They did uncover who the graves were for, and that was right. Betty and Charlie Thomas. And they had been born into slavery and freed during the Civil War, and they died in the 1930s. This also opened up the entire idea that we were talking about a grave site, an African-American cemetery called Black Hope. It becomes this whole other story. Knowing that, all right, so you as a new homeowner, I'm just going to hypothetically put you on the stand.
Okay.
You're putting in the in-ground pool, right? You put down the deposit. You have the machinery there. You find out that there's a body buried in this, on your property. Do you still put in the pool?
Well.
Do you? I mean, you know, like, I'm not saying what's right or wrong.
I would not, no.
Yeah, I don't think I would end up doing it, but I'd still want to. They did. They put the pool in still.
Oh, they did. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, the pool is there. I know that for a somewhat fact. But yeah, from what even in the photos when they show the property later, they're showing a home with a pool in it. So I just thought, well, you know, all right, you're accidentally desecrating graves. You're coming across this African-American cemetery and you want to rebury it, which I think is really nice, but you're not reburying them where they were buried. You're moving them.
Right.
So that you can have a hot tub over there.
They did make a note that in Texas, it's illegal to disturb a grave without the family's permission, which we'll elaborate when we get to the next couple in this segment.
But, you know, there has to be some level of, there's no family. You know, how would you be able to track the family?
Right. And that's the pickle they're in. They wanted to, you know, sue the developer because they built a home on a grave, but they couldn't prove that it was on a grave without digging it up, but they're not allowed to dig up the grave if they don't know who the family is.
Now, in New York, just so everyone knows, I kind of dug into this, that you can actually be buried on your property. You do need to follow local zoning laws, but you can do home burials. All you really need is, to check those local zoning laws, and a funeral director is needed to be involved in the entire process. If it was a contagious disease, you have to report and get, special paperwork, but believe it or not, the body does not even need to be embalmed in New York State. I know that you can also do home burials, and it's basically the same exact situation, except for embalming. If you have an infectious or rare disease, it must be done. Good to know. But I didn't know that. That really surprised me that you can just be buried on your property. I mean, it's not very good for your value of your home, I would imagine. But if you have an estate, sure, why not have a family burial plot if that's the kind of thing that doesn't creep you out too much? Yeah, it was very eye-opening to go down this little home burial thing and
rabbit home burial.
I'm showing it to my wife, and she's like, "Well, no, but thanks, thanks a lot."
The Haneys reburied the couple out of respect, but like Mark said, they did continue on with the swimming pool. And that's when unexplained and paranormal events began to happen. From what I understand, they didn't experience any of it before they disturbed the grave, but they did after.
It definitely seems shocking if we start talking about precisely what has happened. Their accounts are really extraordinary. Haney had an unplugged clock that started short-circuiting and shooting sparks everywhere. Yeah, that's kind of strange, but is it something that, I don't know, was it really unplugged? Did it hold a charge and just kind of freak out? We're not really sure. Judith claims that she was home alone, and then getting after the shower, she heard somebody in the house, and they asked, "What are you doing?" She assumed it was Sam, not, I guess, being able to identify his voice, which I think is kind of strange. I think you can identify your husband's voice, right? The thing that makes the thing even more weird is even if it was Sam, he's supposed to be at work. And in fact, right. He was at work. He had been doing an overnight at work, and she was just at home alone. The next morning when she woke up, she found that one of her pairs of shoes were missing. This is where I kind of roll my eyes a little bit, personally.
Okay. This is my favorite part of the story, because Judith is saying she can't find her shoes, and her husband says, "Well, let me take a look for them. I'll find them for sure." And I just thought it was very typical of an old married couple, and it gave me a little chuckle.
I just think, is it possible? She was looking for her red shoes, and they ended up being on top of the grave of the wife who was reburied.
Betty's birthday, when the day the shoes appeared on her grave.
Yeah, I mean, it would make for the perfect prank. Some people just love to, like, mess with people, and I just can't rule that out. Now,
I'm entertained by it, but yeah. I'm not sure if I found out that a couple was buried on my property, I don't know if I would know enough about them to know when her birthday is, find out her birthday, put a pair of my spouse's shoes on her grave, and then say, there's another ghost thing that happened. If you think about it, it's a pretty elaborate prank.
Well, yes and no. They found out the names of the people who were buried, right? So probably more than likely, if there's a record of their names, there's a record of their birth date. I'm not saying that's what happened. What I'm saying is, I kind of don't buy into the whole it floated out of her closet and landed on the grave type of thing. It makes more sense to me, I guess. And I'm a believer of esoteric and paranormal and these type of phenomenon. It's just, this one is just a little too perfect, I think, for me anyway. So I would need to have a little bit more of more information about the scenario than to just go immediately that they floated out of the closet and landed on the grave. That's all. But the one thing that's related to this that we can't really rule out is that other neighbors are reporting their own strange phenomenon, totally unrelated, very different, such as lights turning on and off, televisions and water faucets turning on and off, strange sounds, and even seeing supernatural apparitions. This is all in a brand new community. Yeah, apparitions. But, you know, this isn't a brand new community. When you buy a brand new house, you kind of have this new feeling, I think, because I've never lived in a brand new house. It's like new car smell. I don't know. I think that there's something here to it. Something about the shoe thing doesn't resonate with me. So Ben and Jean Williams, two new people who I fell in love with, I think that these are the perfect people to live next door to. They moved into the neighborhood around the same time as the Haneys. Shortly after moving in, she noticed that all of her plants were dying. She would plant things in her garden or yard, and they just really weren't taking to the soil, and they were just dying. They noticed that there were sinkholes that were forming, which is just horrifying. Claim that they're the unmistakable shape of a coffin.
And they would fill them in only to have them reappear a few days later.
Now, I don't know anything about digging graves, thankfully. But I do know that they need to be backfilled. Because what I'm going to guess is that when a body is buried, that eventually, I mean, we're talking maybe 100 years goes by, whatever material that is, unless it's like steel or aluminum or something really strong, the wood is going to rot from all the moisture and the just the elements. We'll get to it. And eventually we'll cave in, I would imagine. So it would create this sinkhole. But the sinkhole wouldn't come back over and over again, I don't think.
There were also strange markings on a tree near the sinkholes.
Yeah.
A longtime resident told the couple that he had marked the tree. The 30s, or beforehand, when the cemetery was still a cemetery, if families couldn't afford a headstone, that's how they would mark the grave, is a mark a tree nearby.
Which is nice, I think. I think it's a nice idea and concept. You know, it's like a living marker. But yeah, but the Williams, when the Williams learned that the markings represented the death of, I believe, two sisters, was it? At that location, at least on the Unsolved Mysteries discussion, she seemed to be really taken back by that. She felt as though she really genuinely violated their resting place. And she just was like, we desecrated this. This is terrible. Well, another thing with the sinkhole I do want to mention is this is all a brand new development. So they've dug up, they've refilled, they put in plumbing systems, and there's all types of reasons why the grounds might settle in different locations. And I would imagine that is it possible that the coffin was intact until all of this construction started happening? And then from all of this really kind of disturbing the soil and everything, that's when it caved in. I don't know. It's one of my biggest fears is to see this kind of coffin-shaped thing, sinkhole. It's very creepy. There's a story that happened just maybe 2 years ago here on Long Island where somebody went to go visit their loved one. I'll dig this up and put it in the show notes, where she's putting flowers on a loved one's grave and she starts sinking into the grave because it wasn't backfilled properly. She had to claw her way out of the grave. And this is hard. I mean, you're picturing it, right? It's scary. She sued the crap out of them because it's like, you don't sleep well that night.
I can imagine. There's a meme on the internet and I'll try to find it, but it says something like, when I was a kid, I was led to believe that quicksand is a bigger issue than it actually is.
I talk about that all the time. So the story doesn't really just stop there. There's a lot of phenomena that there's a lot of things going on. The Williams start experiencing a lot of different things, random shadows. They live with their daughter and their granddaughter. We're not really sure of their situation. It's not really that important. They do mention that the granddaughter lives there. They don't mention that the daughter lives there, but I'm going to assume that the daughter also lives there. I did find out that the granddaughter that's in this, you know, she's kind of moved on and she's has kids and she's all happy and everything. But I'm talking about Carly. She has a quote here that sometimes it would be very, very chilly and you'd have this feeling of foreboding. And they would use the word foreboding a lot in this reenactment or retelling of the story. Or just, you know, just like something isn't right.
Okay.
They claim that toilets would flush on their own. As the water went down, they said that they would hear the resonating of voices, which I think is it's a very eerie concept. This is a little bit of a humorous thing, but there's this HBO documentary about women and men in kind of a co-ed prison. And what they do is communicate through the plumbing. And they do a thing called toilet talk. And 50% of the people listening to this podcast might know what I'm talking about. And they're probably laughing and saying, I can't believe he's saying toilet talk. But that's what my wife and I said. We're like, oh my God, it's toilet talk. We at that point, we just started laughing until the story kept going. Because this becomes a very light haunting to something that's kind of tragic.
They have family members get sick. I think they said 3 family members got cancer.
Yeah.
And 2 of them, I think 2 succumbed.
Oh, no, 6 of them. 6 of them got cancer. 3 of them died.
And yeah, a few of them actually died. And then they do a little montage of the family members. And I thought that was really sweet and sad at the same time.
Yeah, I think it's a terrible story and everything. I just don't know if we can blame all of it on what we're kind of alluding to is voodoo, really. I mean, I'm not really sure if we can put all the blame into this. But at the same time, of course, it's a tragic story. At this point, the Haneys are a little bit, or more than just a little bit, they're really annoyed. They're seeing that the neighbors are going, the Williams are going through this, and they're going through their own thing. So they decided to sue the developers for not disclosing that the home is built over a cemetery. And originally, the jury said, you know what, you're right. Mental anguish, here's $142,000. And they were probably like, this is great. I'm going to buy that 1985 BMW. But the judge basically decided to reverse the entire judgment and rule that the developer was not responsible.
Which I, how is the developer not responsible? I'm wondering what evidence went into the reversal.
What I'm going to guess, and this is purely a guess, you're only responsible for what's been reported to you, right? So it might be a matter of passing the buck, and they might have been able to, if they could have afforded it, sue someone else. But I'm going to guess that this entire property had not been a cemetery for decades, and it was no longer zoned, or was maybe never zoned as a cemetery, and that's really on the county and the state's, you know, responsibility, so, you know, having different certificates of occupancy for houses and commercial certificates. How can the developer be responsible for something that they were not aware of? It's really as simple as that. I'm thinking if the developer knew about it, if they had any indication of this as being a cemetery, then of course they would disclose it. But they wouldn't learn of this, of course, until they started breaking ground.
Gotcha.
I don't understand why the Haneys have to pay $50,000 in court costs.
The Williams or the Haneys that sued?
I believe it was the Haneys who sued.
Okay.
They had to file for bankruptcy at this point. I mean, they did. They probably had this mortgage. They seem like maybe at retirement age, perhaps. And on top of it, they're being handed a $50,000 court bill. And from what I understand, I couldn't get a clear answer on this. They just kind of left. They said, enough. Like, we're just going to cash out and leave. But the Williams also tried to push their legal action towards the developers. But the developers wanted proof that the cemetery even existed in the first place. So in one of the creepiest segments,
aspects
I think,
of the
this is where things get kind of really crazy. Is Jean, the mother, decided to start digging up her backyard for remains. She's like, if you want proof, I'll give you proof.
And she said, I figure I can dig about 2 feet a day.
It's like, you're a real Texan, because that's, you know, it's hot out. That, I mean, she's right. She want, you know, you want remains, I'll give you remains. As she's digging, she started feeling ill. So her daughter, Tina, stepped in, said, look, Mom, I'll finish the job. After about a half an hour, she started to feel unwell. Now, I have a quote here from the granddaughter. I remember her saying that she felt funny. She was getting dizzy as well. She put the shovel down and went back inside. And she just lay down on the couch. She's like, Mom, Daddy, I don't feel right. There's something wrong. The last thing I remember her saying was, Mommy, take care of my baby, take care of my baby. And she looked so scared. So she lay down on the couch, but continued just to feel worse. Her father called 911, and Tina was rushed to the hospital. She had It turns out that she had suffered a massive heart attack. And she would
30
tragically
years old.
Yeah, and tragically, she would die 2 days later. She was only 30 years old. Jean, her mother, believes that the death was caused by supernatural forces. And I don't, you know what? I mean, I would probably have to agree with her on this. This is where I reverse on everything. You know, I may not believe in the shoes, but I believe in her death. I mean, we see a little bit of a moment between Carly and the grandmother. And it doesn't seem like the grandmother and Carly have a very solid connection on camera. Do you think that maybe she blames the grandmother for this? Because had she not started digging, her mother...
I don't think so. You know, I'm sure they staged the reunion between grandmother and granddaughter, maybe just the staging aspect of that made it look like they weren't close.
Yeah. Well, the Williams end up losing their entire investment in their house, and they moved to Montana.
Yeah.
But then they did return to Texas, but in a completely different neighborhood. According to unsolved.com, I was reading through some people who claim to live in the property. There's no paranormal activity there. There's nothing weird. It's just a regular community. And I found a nice house. You know, you can get like kind of a very modern house for about $300,000, four bedrooms, two baths. And it's like one of these like tiny McMansion type of things. And,
is it 300 in today's money?
Yeah, 300. Okay. I have a link to it. I'll put a link to it. But it's a really nice house. You know, it's a cute little house, two-car garage. It's modern. I'll tell you, for $300,000, this house is outstanding. This is easily an $800,000 house on Long Island. Crosby, Texas, y'all. Y'all.
And I think that's a suburb of Houston or near Houston.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, it's considered Newport Crosby, Texas, which is just like, I don't know how it all works down there with y'all, not you all, but them all. And it's just, there's no flood factor, we'll just say that. You're not really near any water, and it looks like a nice community, to be honest with you. Just, you know, maybe go in there with a seer so that you can find out if there's any negative spirits, if that's your thing. But moving on, we have Connor's cop. After spending a long weekend with their divorced father, Amber and Brittany return to their home that they share with their mom, Joanne, who is, I don't know if we ever, oh, no, she's divorced because they spent the time with their father, who's who kind of gets them on the weekend. But they're divorced. She's 39 years old. They come home. They're begging for pizza, but Joanne is not there. They find her purse and jewelry, and while that's not completely strange, she normally showers, takes off the jewelry, and puts it on right away. So they're kind of like, all right, what's going on? You know, it's kind of strange, but it's not totally uncommon that she wouldn't be there. Just leaving her purse and jewelry is kind of strange.
Another thing I read, too, was that Joanne was a stickler for turning lights off when she left the room.
Really?
And all the lights were on.
Yeah, like stuff like that, telltale signs. You would also think that somebody would be smart enough to know that about somebody when abducting them, but maybe you're not really in the most clear state of mind. But after Joanne failed to show up for the next several days, she's reported missing. Las Vegas police detectives soon discover that also her boyfriend is missing, John Edwards, not the medium, different John Edwards. So over the next few days, Joanne and John just are gone. He's not showing up anywhere and there's no communication. So it's getting really kind of questionable. We don't get an update as to how panicked her kids are, even her ex-husband, but I'm sure that they're terrified.
From what I understand, the Las Vegas police didn't really jump at the investigation when the kids got home and couldn't find their mom. Her car wasn't there, but the boyfriend's truck was there.
Mm-hmm.
So they called their dad and said, we don't know where mom is. The dad called the police and was like, hey, my ex-wife is missing. The police were like, well, she probably just went on vacation with her boyfriend and didn't tell anybody.
So even though she's missing at this point, they didn't take a missing persons report, even though she's missing for a period of time.
So the truck was there, and I can't remember if it was Joanne's sister or Joanne's friend said, well, this is the boyfriend's truck. Can I search the truck? And the police officer was like, yeah, sure. Do whatever you want. I don't care. So they go and they search the truck. And that's when they find a duct taped wallet.
So they found the wallet in the truck.
Yeah.
Oh, because when they do the reenactment, it seems as though they're searching his apartment.
Right. And they made it seem like the police found it when in reality, the family found it.
Thanks a lot, Las Vegas police.
They found several IDs, but they also found the ID of John Addis.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when they go into his backstory. Was born in Michigan, actually, right by where I'm from. Married Jody, and he decided he wanted to live off the land, and they moved to Alaska, where he...
Yeah, he hunted like caribou, right?
Yeah. And he became a state trooper in Alaska and was an expert in crime scene investigation.
This, I mean, it's crazy, right? I mean, we go from him being a personal trainer, They're saying how what a handsome and charismatic gentleman he is, and he meets her, and she's so happy to have met this person. And I mean, the reenactor, I don't know. I wasn't catching the whole vibe of like him being all wonderful and charismatic. It seems to me that he was really obnoxious even before he started showing that he was being like obnoxious. I mean, we get the reenactments. I mean, if she's dealing with him on a day-to-day basis, she must know that he's kind of a jerk.
Right. And I loved the reenactments in this segment. They're at like a mall food court, and he says, "Is this strawberry?"
She's like, "Yeah, I think it is strawberry. It looks like strawberry."
Yeah, it looks like strawberry. And, "You got me the wrong drink. Are you stupid or something?"
It bummed me out.
She's like, "John, stop. John, stop."
And she's like, "Will you shut up?" And it was like, yeah, what?
Loved the reenactments.
And we find out also John Edwards is a bit of a snorer. So he basically lives off of her earnings.
Joanne's friend that set them up said they would go out to dinner and he would complain and he would be controlling. Yeah. And she paid for everything. She would put gas in his car. She would always buy the food.
Can I ask you about the duct tape wallet? What do you yes. think of that? Like, if you personally see a duct tape wallet, what's the first thing you're going to do? You're going to open it, right? If right. I just see a wallet, I would be more likely to not open a wallet that doesn't have duct tape on it.
I would think it was probably tucked away, like in the glove box or something, and they were digging through the truck and found the duct tape wallet. I don't think that it was in plain sight for Joanne to see.
Yeah,
I don't think
it was Joanne his backup really... ID, definitely.
Right. I don't think Joanne really knew about his past. I think she was going to break up with him because he was a jerk.
Well, that's what we learn. We learn from friends that allegedly she's going to, we're going to call it off. This isn't working out, John. And from what we've learned, the worst and most scariest time for a woman is when she's trying to break up with a man. And that is usually, right. It seems to be the trigger. On a lot of violence and a lot of murders and a lot of disappearances. And this is exactly what kind of happens. She was about to break up with him and she goes missing the next day. We discover that she does go disappear. She goes and vanishes. There's nothing kind of showing up, but they do find her body, not her body. They find her car.
They found her car somewhere in Arizona.
Yeah. In Prescott, Arizona, they found the car parked in the remote desert area.
Yeah. 3 days after she disappeared, they found her car. So they're like, okay, what's she doing in Arizona? Maybe this lady's actually missing. Maybe we should do something about it. There's another detective. I forget her name, but she is absolutely gorgeous.
She has her hair done. Her makeup is done perfectly. It's funny. I was going to do a quick search on her and I kind of just didn't get to it. But she looks like she should be on Law and Order in the 80s.
So she ends up investigating John Edwards and his background. His real name is John Addis. He had 4 kids with his first wife. They also interview his first wife, Jody. She seems like a badass bitch to me. She seems like a really cool lady.
Jody has been through it, I think. And Jody's right. like, I was abused by this man. I mean, that's essentially what she's, having the courage to just kind of put her face to, And there's a crazy reenactment where he's being a lunatic. She's in the truck and she's like, "I've had enough of this." And at like 50 miles per hour, she just jumps out of the truck.
But he went after her and grabbed her and threw her back in the car. And she was granted a divorce. Like, oh, thanks.
Well, I think when they say granted, it's one of those things where I don't know how it is in Alaska, but it could be that you need 2 parties to agree to divorce. It can't be a one party decision. But I think when it comes to escaping from somebody at 50 miles per hour and then getting your shoulder dislocated and then thrown back into the truck, there might be a loophole there to allow you to get a divorce from an abusive husband. Maybe.
Right. That's what I thought as well. But yeah. it just seemed like it was a prize to her.
Now, we do.
Congratulations, we gave you a divorce.
We do learn a lot about his history in Alaska, which I don't think really applies so much to this case. But it is really interesting. It's worth watching this episode. I think that they do a really great reenactment. It starts feeling a little bit like the movie Fargo a little bit. Like there's a certain, it's a decent level of production on this particular episode.
Our lady cop friend, she was just highlighting the fact that his violence towards women escalated with his relationships. He married a second time and she left him. And then he was particularly violent with his third wife, who he was choking right after she had a baby, choking her so hard that it lifted her feet off the ground.
Yeah, this is, it's a horrifying thing to just, I mean, you're healing from having a child, and it's like this complete monster is choking you to death so much so that he's lifted you up. I mean, this guy.
Right, and they didn't mention this in the Unsolved Mysteries segment, but when I was reading about it, she was actually holding the baby.
Oh my God.
And feeding the baby. Like the bottle fell on the floor, the baby started crying, and he's just choking her ground.
This reeks to me of being like a massive cokehead or something. Like this guy just has other issues outside of just mental illness.
And they said he didn't drink or do drugs or anything. He was just.
I don't buy that. Just don't buy it. And I'll mention why when we discuss what happens to him. On October 9th, 1998, a hiker discovers Joanne's remains, which were 1 mile from where her car was abandoned. All right, a mile is a big distance from anything, a square mile. But I don't know. I just feel like maybe they didn't do a thorough search. Like maybe bring in a dog.
I think her vehicle was found like in a desert, and her remains were found like up a mountain. So he carried her up this mountain and hid her.
But a dog, and they said, you know, a dog would be able to sense that, I believe. Well, again, you know, the guy has a history. I mean, he knows what he's doing. So it's very possible that he chose this location purely for this exact reason, to throw them off. Clearly, he knows what he knew what he was doing, because they didn't find the body. In the reenactment, it's skeletalized. Is that a word? At the time of the airing, he remained at large. It was still kind of an unsolved mystery. And it was even profiled on America's Most Wanted and featured on FBI's Criminal Pursuit. Now, the ending where we find out the next step, which is where we finally get to some level of a conclusion here. It seems so simple when I looked into what Unsolved Mysteries puts forward. But you uncovered some difficult to follow information, but a lot more information. So if you don't mind, I'm just going to throw it towards you to conclude this, because the simplicity, I don't know. I don't believe the Unsolved Mystery. It's just too simple.
The update was very vague, and I did have to do several Google searches. It was very difficult to find more information. I finally found a book, The True Story of One Man's Descent into Madness and Murder by Glenn Pewitt. And that had some more information. They had the name of the woman he was supposedly found with, and her name was Laura Liliana Padilla. She met John at her gym. She was 25 years old. He was in his mid to late 40s. And her family actually met him, but her dad kind of got this vibe that they were just friends because he was so much older than her. So one day her sister goes to her apartment and there's a note from her saying that John proposed marriage and they're going to run off and elope. Mm-hmm. And that was actually several years before she died. She was married to him, had 2 kids with him.
So they were his kids, right? Or allegedly, we think they are.
Allegedly, they are his 2 kids. And she was missing and gone from her family for several years, but she was alive during that time. And so they lived in an apartment in Guadalajara. After a couple days, their neighbors hadn't seen the family in a couple days. So this is in October of 2006. Their neighbors hadn't seen them in several days. So they go to check on them and notice a horrible smell. And Laura, along with her two young children, were found murdered in their home. They died of carbon monoxide poisoning, but there were over 20 syringes found nearby.
Now, we don't know exactly what the syringes were for. Were they for everyday drug use? Was somebody diabetic? Was,
right.
You know, we don't know. There's like just not any information, but it does fall in line with what I'm saying is that it just seemed like he's kind of like a junkie with these rage things, you know?
Like a roid rage, maybe.
Possibly, yeah, you know what? I didn't think of that. Yeah, it absolutely could be.
Because they say how, you know, fit and muscular and athletic he was, but he supposedly didn't drink or do drugs. Maybe he did steroids.
Yeah, maybe it was like speed and steroids, you know? But, you know, what I think that's interesting is that I think it's of the same year. In Guatemala City.
So they were discovered on October 18th, but they had been dead for several days.
Okay.
So John Addis checked into a hotel in Guatemala City on October 14th. So he probably killed his family, went on the run. A few days after that, a hotel maid found him dead of a heart attack at age 56.
They did suspect suicide. But yeah, the postmortem reports state that he had a heart attack, and like you said, 56. So, all right, while it's not completely impossible that he would have a heart attack at 56, I would imagine having a heart attack at 56 would be in line with somebody who is using forms of barbiturates or cocaine or speed or even steroids. And that's kind of where it ends, and it's considered closed because it's sad.
I did read also that Detective Hannah, who was one of the Las Vegas police officers, suspected that John may have murdered a lookalike and continued to be on the lam.
Mm.
But fingerprint identification proved otherwise.
Well, let's bring this to Halloween 2001.
Disappearance of Cindy Song.
Yes, Cindy Song. Poor Cindy Song. Cindy Song was born in Seoul, South Korea, and she moved to Springfield, Virginia in 1995 to live with her aunt and uncle as she attended school in the United States, and she was scheduled to graduate in the spring of 2002. On Halloween, you know, she had this really strict work ethic. She was in a special graduate program. She was working like two different jobs. She was a hardworking student, and like so many people who might even be listening to this podcast right now. But for Halloween, she chose to take the night off from studying and enjoy herself with her friends, Stacy Paik and Lisa Kim. They decided to go to a club called Players Nightclub for Halloween and just kind of hang out. Cindy being Cindy, she dressed up as a bunny in a white tennis skirt, bunny ears, and a tail. On Unsolved Mysteries, they mentioned that it was a cute bunny, and that's kind of how she was. She was a cute girl. And I think the reason why they really bring this up is mostly to take it out of everyone's thought that she was a slutty bunny. You know, I guess it's
to
slut shame you on paper. And it's just the fact that we have to even talk about that is horrible because it's like we're talking about a disappearance of somebody. And it's like it shouldn't matter what she's wearing.
I think at the time, too, dressing up as a Playboy bunny was very popular.
Yeah.
And they probably wanted to indicate that she wasn't a Playboy bunny, but actually say Playboy.
Now, this is also a very turbulent time in the United States. It's 6 weeks after the 9/11 attacks. You know, this is...
I didn't even realize that. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, so not to say that really has anything to do with this, but I would imagine calling the police, it would... Everything is... Your real focus is on whether or not we're going to get bombed again. At least I remember it that way, as, you know, everything was put on hold. Unless it was like a crazy, crazy thing happening, it was all put on hold. So she's at the bar until about 2 a.m. She leaves Players Nightclub and goes to a friend's house to play, I don't know, what would she be playing? Nintendo 64. And
Mario Party?
Yeah, Mario Party, exactly. 4 a.m., Stacy Paik drops her off at the Park Apartments on Clinton Avenue. I have a link to the apartments. They're nice little apartments. Again, they're still running at a reasonable price for students, about $1,200, $1,300 a month. Cindy had a few drinks that night, but she was just mildly intoxicated. So I don't want anybody to think like, all right, she went home, she's wasted, and she just went out to party 2.0, you know, at 4 a.m. It wasn't really in her character to be like that. But just like everybody else at the party, she was drinking and she was of age. So there really shouldn't be a question of any of that. The thing is that after Stacy dropped her off, she was never seen again. The next day, Cindy's roommate came home. She had been away with visiting her family, and she did not find Cindy. The door was locked. There seemed to be no signs of a struggle or Jimmy in a lock or any of that kind of stuff. Cindy was simply not there. 3 days after Halloween, after the drop-off, the friends, unable to really reach her, reported her missing to police. This is where it all just kind of blows up. We take it really seriously at this point. They find that she had to have gone to her apartment, even though her friend dropped her off. She didn't see her going to the apartment, but there's an indication that she was in the apartment physically. She had taken off the fake eyelashes. She had left her backpack with her cell phone. The only things that were missing, actually, were her keys and her purse.
And her bunny ears.
Oh, right, and the bunny ears.
They couldn't find the bunny ears.
You're absolutely
either.
Right. So, but there's still no signs of any type of foul play. There was a 24-hour convenience store that was right within the vicinity of the apartment complex that she would go to at any time. You know, she would just kind of run down there and grab a Red Bull or something like that and come back home. And she would go into costume because it's like, she's like, all right, I got to just run out and get milk. Who knows, you know?
Right. Well, she's been drinking. She probably wanted a little snick snack. She probably
right.
doesn't need to bring her whole purse, grabbed her wallet, went for a bag of chips, and
yeah.
who knows?
One thing I cannot find, I don't know if you found anything here. I don't know if we even discussed this. Was anybody at the 24-hour convenience store questioned? I can find nothing.
I couldn't find anything either. They mentioned, oh, she may have gone, but did anybody see her? Did anybody ask if they saw her?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. And that's like the biggest.
That's the big tell right there. You know, it's like, yeah, she came in and grabbed, you know, chips and then left. I mean, okay, well, that is something. But no, we don't know.
Or maybe something. Maybe the 24-hour market is key in there withholding whatever they found.
Yeah.
At the market.
Well, the investigators scoured her emails and confirmed there was no kind of communication through her emails. Her cell phone was not with her. The cell phone was pretty ubiquitous with her. So the fact that she didn't have it was it was a very scary thing for her friends to see. And there was also no activity on her credit cards, which she did have on her when she left. So that's kind of interesting. When her family learned of this, they traveled from South Korea. And the first thing they did, and when I first read about this, I thought there was something sketchy about it, but I really don't think there was. They cleaned her apartment. And I think it was probably just like college pigsty. And her mother's like, well, I'm going to clean everything. Because when she comes back, I want it to be clean. Because her mother is really keeping this investigation alive. Even, you know, throughout, for years and years and years, she just kind of kept it in the public's eye. Several days after Cindy was reported missing, though, we do get a report from a couple hundred miles away in Philadelphia's Chinatown district that a woman that looks like Cindy is having an altercation with a man being forced into a car. He yells at the person watching to leave them alone.
Mm-hmm.
This story changed a lot. So I don't think it's a very solid lead, but for whatever reason, the police do want to speak to the person that the male that's involved in that, and they just give a basic description. He's Oliver, light skinned, medium length hair. But they're saying that although he's not a suspect in the case, they still want to question him. But I think that was purely coincidence. It's too far. It's not realistic to me. There's no real connection. And plus, the story changed so often.
You brought up that her mom cleaned her apartment, and yes, that could be detrimental to physical evidence, but I really think she was abducted out of her apartment.
I couldn't agree more. This happened on her way to that 24-hour convenience store.
I think as well.
Or back from, who knows, you know, she left the apartment willingly to go do something, to run an errand. And in between those few minutes, she was abducted. In June 2003, this guy, Paul Weekly, who's facing a felony burglary charge, and he mentions that his friend Hugo Selinsky and friends Michael Kirkowski and Hugo Selinsky had abducted Cindy Song while she was walking down the street. They thought that she was a prostitute.
May I interrupt?
Yeah, sure.
This segment was not discussed in Unsolved Mysteries, correct?
Correct. Like, some of the stuff that we're bringing up is really just stuff that you and I had dug through these different cases. And there's a lot of articles out there about this. And this became a little bit of a rabbit hole. So I'm going to try my best to not go down the rabbit hole, because Hugo Selinsky alone is just, you know, is a topic for an entire podcast. I also don't know if there's anything to this, because there's some, I'll bring it up in just a minute, but essentially it's being told that they mistook her as a sex worker, abducted her, brought her to Michael Kirkowski's house, but they kept her in a walk-in safe, and they basically raped her and tortured her until she died, and they buried her somewhere. When I read about this the first time, I was just really, oh my God, what a terrible, terrible, you know, you're going to get potato chips and you're getting abducted. It's just, you know, the whole thing is so heartbreaking. When you dive into the story a little bit more, investigators are skeptical if the story about Selinsky and Kirkowski, abducting and murdering Cindy Song is true, because they found on the person who ratted them out, the person who told them of this story, that on his computer, he had downloaded several articles about Cindy. He had known about her case very, very well. It's possible that he fabricated this as just something to maybe seek revenge on the guy, or to have some like leverage so that it appears that he has information. And I believe,
interesting,
it gives me hope that somebody didn't go through what we're saying. But the fact of the matter is, Cindy Song's body is yet to be recovered. We just don't know what happened. Is it better to know precisely, you know, a theory like that and believe it, or is it better to kind of have hope that something less tragic happened? I don't know. I don't know which is worse. I couldn't imagine being a parent and having to go through that, especially from another country, such a distance. They did search his house, and they did find over a dozen bodies. So you would think, all right, he's definitely guilty, right? But none of those bodies were Cindy's.
And it's worth noting that one of the bodies was his associate and his girlfriend.
Yeah, it was Kirkowski. And, you know, the theory is that Kirkowski is the person who really did, you know, the attack on Cindy. And he allegedly kept the bunny ears as a trophy, which annoyed Selinsky enough to kill him and his girlfriend. But he's guilty of that. He's guilty of these murders, but there's no sign of Cindy. It's just a really scary scenario that we're putting out there, but we're just not really sure. In March of 2006, Selinsky was acquitted of the murder charges against him, but he was convicted of two counts of abuse of a corpse. This case is so scattered. I can't find, like, I don't know how you can have 14 corpses buried in your backyard and get acquitted of murder charges. Maybe you didn't murder them. I'm just not really sure. Maybe they're manslaughter charges.
When they supposedly abducted Cindy and brought her to this property, he hadn't moved on to the property until after Cindy Song disappeared.
Oh, that's interesting. I did read about that. I wasn't sure if there was any legitimacy. The problem with all of the Selinsky stuff is that it can go one way or the other way. It's all misinformation, and then it's new information, and then it's all proven to be lies. And it's such a deep case to talk about. I don't know if he shows up on another episode of Unsolved Mysteries, but I'm really kind of hoping he does, because I think he's worth discussing. As for Cindy Song, we're several decades after this happening, and there are dozens of files that are just sitting in the Ferguson Township collecting dust, and it remains unsolved to this day.
Right. And they think, too, one theory the police brought up was that she wanted to run away, get away from this life, or possibly suicide, because she had just broken up with her boyfriend. Yeah, but I do really
I don't buy that at all. I mean,
no,
when you're going to commit suicide,
she had Britney Spears tickets.
Yeah, she had Britney Spears tickets. Come on.
We forgot to mention that earlier. I wanted to make sure we brought up the Britney Spears tickets.
But when you're going to commit suicide, you don't usually make plans for the future. You don't go and buy Britney Spears tickets. You're not the type of person who listens to Britney Spears if you're suicidal, really. You're just like all happy that Britney Spears is coming. She also had a computer that she had ordered and paid for, and it was being shipped. These are not actions of somebody who is going to run away from their life or commit suicide. Correct. And like you said, she had just broken up with her boyfriend, or he broke up with her, but she was moving on. She was a little bit depressed, like most people would be at 21, but she was moving on. She wasn't suicidal. She doesn't fall into the category of a depressed person. Now, granted, when somebody does commit suicide, the first thing people usually say is what? I can't imagine them doing it. I didn't see the signs, you know, those types. So if you are depressed, just remember it will pass. To always have to go to suicide as a possibility, I guess, is a necessity. But I just think with some people, it just doesn't make any sense. But nonetheless, Catherine, I want to thank you so much for going through this. It's our first episode. We definitely hit a few bumps, but I think for the most part, we got our stories out.
I think so too. I'm excited to keep going. And I think with more practice, we'll iron out the wrinkles.
100%. Our notes look like a crazy person's chapter one. And I love it. It looks great. But yeah, I have to thank you so much for putting the time that you've put into doing the research, putting up with my crazy, level of research. But eventually we'll figure it out. We'll get into the flow of things. And I hope the people who are listening enjoy it. I had a great time talking about this.
I did too, Mark.
Tonight we have been confronted with an entire catalog of unexplained and unsolved events. Tune in next time as Unsolved Mysteries Rewind discusses another collection of unsolved mysteries. Until then, we can only look and wonder.